Welcome to Ambleside Flourish, brought to you by Ambleside Schools International. This is our series on the pursuit of maturity with Dr. Bill St. Cyr, Executive Director of Ambleside Schools International, hosted by Ambleside School of Colorado. Part 2.
All right, this is the second in a series of three talks. This one's on the pursuit of maturity. So this is part 2 on the pursuit of maturity. I mentioned that there are five different maturity levels when we think of emotional relational maturity, which I'm convinced is the most important thing. Emotional relational maturity has to do with how well we handle life both as an individual and with others. It's a little different from cognitive maturity, which is just how well do we process information. I'm interested in how well we handle life and handle life together. My sources are three. One, the work of E. James Wilder, who is, frankly, he's the sharpest Christian psychologist I know. I have the privilege of serving on his board. And for over 30 years, he's practiced clinical psychology in Southern California. And his question was, how do you bring people to maturity? And many of the people he worked with came from the most broken of situations. Then another source is obviously the writings of Charlotte Mason. I think over 100 years ago, she understood some things about the nature of the human brain and the human person that much of the 20th century forgot. Interestingly, a couple of years ago, Mary Ellen had been reading one of our favorite neuroscientists, a guy by the name of Jeffrey Schwartz, who teaches at UCLA. He is probably the world's foremost expert on the treatment of obsessive compulsive disorder without using medication. And we had just read his book, The Mind and the Brain. And it reminded us of Charlotte Mason. So Mary Ellen sent him off a little letter and sent him a quote from Charlotte Mason's writings. And he wrote back and said, "Amazing, she was 100 years ahead of her time." Now here's one of the top neuroscientists in the world today saying that Charlotte Mason got it right in terms of brain science 100 years ago. So that's the second source. And then third is my own personal experience reading thousands of hours in counseling, not just for myself, but counseling others and their experiences. So that's my foundation, five stages of emotional maturity. First, the infant stage. And we'll go through these together because I'm in good Ambleside form. Well, I'm not going to ask you to retell them, okay? But at least we'd want to get the five in our mind so that you can track with me. First, there's the infant level of maturity, then the child level of emotional relational maturity, the adult, the parent, and the elder. So we talked about that a little bit last time. Now, let me tell you what's most important at each stage. Infant level. The most important thing for an infant is learning to receive from others. Baby's born in the world. Baby doesn't know anything about what life's about. Baby has to receive everything from someone else. Not just food, but their very way of envisioning life, of seeing and understanding the world, of knowing what's worth having and what's not worth having. Infant level, primary task, learning to receive from others. Child level maturity. Primary task, to take care of self while being kind to others. So what is it that we really want a child to learn to do? To take care of him or herself while being kind to others. The adult level of maturity. To learn how to take care of two people simultaneously. So now I'm no longer just vested in taking care of myself. I am equally vested in taking care of you. I can actually perform the rather complex task, and we'll talk a bit about how complex that task is, of caring for both of us at the same time. The parent level of maturity, sacrificially taking care of children. And the elder level of maturity, to sacrificially take care of the community. That is the job, the task of someone who has completed the raising of their own children and is now to function as a senior member of our community. Their job description is now to sacrificially care for the whole community. And we'll talk about the challenges implicit in that. All right, that's the overview. Five stages: infant, learning to receive from others; child, taking care of self while being kind to others; adult, taking care of two people simultaneously. I'm taking care of me and I'm taking care of you. Parent, sacrificially taking care of children; elder, sacrificially taking care of the community. And I suggested last time that we talked that the vast majority of Americans are functioning at an infant and a child level of maturity, that they have not mastered those tasks, that most Americans don't really know how to emotionally, relationally take care of themselves. And that leads to all forms of addictions. Addiction is a way to take care of yourself emotionally, relationally, that is counterproductive, dysfunctional, and ends up doing more damage than good. All right, let's now break them down stage by stage. Infant, okay, infant level, ideally birth through age three. These are the issues that a child birth through age three should be dealing with. We talked some about them last time, so I'll just be brief. They learn to receive from others. Specific tasks, principally, to learn to live in joy. Joy is a gift that you can only get from somebody else until you've developed the skill yourself. Joy is, it's good, as you might recall, joy is, it's good to be me here with you. And that experience I only discover in the face of another. That children aren't born joyful apart from community. And we've talked about the joy game, right? Remember the joy game? Mom's holding baby. Mom looks down. Baby smiles a little bit. Mom smiles. Baby smiles a little bit larger. Mom smiles a little bit more. Baby gives a big smile and goes, wee, and looks away. Because it's more joy than the child can take. Well, that's hugely important, because what mom and baby are doing in this nonverbal dialogue is saying, isn't it great to be together? I love you. You love me, I love you. Isn't it great to be together? And that dialogue in many ways, shapes, and forms is huge to developing a secure self. Thus, the most important task to learn to receive the joy that can then be built into a child's life that provides a solid foundation. We also mentioned as part of that, the development of trust, the ability to organize self through imitation. You notice a little one, 3 years old, and they're following around, imitating the significant adults in their lives. Why do little ones like to play dress up, mimic adults? They're trying to figure out who they are. And we don't figure out who we are simply from the inside. We always figure out who we are by being in relationship with someone else. The true self is not discovered by navel gazing. All right, that's not how you discover who you are. We discover who we are in relationship with others who see us and know us. So our very identities, in a sense, are a gift from those around us. We learn to master our bodies. Even that is something that we receive as a gift. And when you think of the skill of mastering your body, making your body do what it ought to do, that does not happen apart from a community that has expectations. In other words, I will never learn to sit appropriately in a chair unless I grow up in a community that has the expectation that I sit in a chair in a certain way. Now, that's a very mundane example. But what we do with our body, the way we honor personal space, the way we control ourselves, that doesn't happen apart from a community whose norms or traditions we receive and embrace and thereby learn how to live in this community. You know, as we think and talk this way, one of the things we begin to discover is that the American myth of the autonomous self is just that, a myth. That we are all relational beings, and our sense of self is relationally created. I'd recommend a book by the New York Times columnist David Brooks, a very musing novel, but very insightful here. It was published last summer, I believe. It's entitled The Social Animal. He says, no. We humans, we discover who we are in relationship. And that starts. So what's the task for the child, for the infant? To learn to receive from you who I am. And who I am ought to be. Another part of that, cultivated curiosity. We learn to receive the whole world as a gift. You know, our desire for all our students at Ambleside, for in fact, all children, is that they would have many relationships with many things. If there is a person who does not like math, who isn't curious about number and how all that works, who isn't curious about stars in the heavens and why they move across the skies like they move, and why they're different intensities of light, if you're not curious about how cells divide, or how peoples lived 2,000, 4,000 years ago, or how they live today in a different land far away. If we're not curious about that, something's gone wrong. We resist the notion, reject the notion, that there are some people who are math students, math people, and some people who are literature people, and some people who are art people, and some people who are music people. Nonsense. Now, it is true, there are some who are more gifted in those areas. But if we don't all want to learn everything we possibly can about God's world and aren't curious about it and aren't interested in it, something's gone wrong. And it's a sad thing. There's been a loss. Didn't have to be that way. We want our children, our students, to have intimate relations with many things. This goes back, and going back to, from the very beginning, that infant stage of development, children their world will be as big as we present it to them. No child comes into this world knowing how big his world is. It will be as big as we present it to them. And if a child is presented with a world that's basically limited to a screen, and that's their world, as they grow up, they really won't have much of a relationship with anything outside of that screen. And do we want children to have relationship with a digital flat screen or with flowers and stars and people of history and people down the street and doing geological excavations out in the front yard? I mean, do we want many relationships? And if so, but you see, again, children don't come into the world knowing. They don't know what's worth having, what's not worth having. And their world will only be as big as the world that we give them. This reminds me of when I was thinking through this, I was reminded of one of my favorite quotes of C.S. Lewis. In the collection of essays, The Weight of Glory, Lewis says, "It would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at sea. We are far too easily pleased." Now, there is something here that I'd like you to think about. Perhaps the real problem is not that so many of our children desire too much, it's that they desire too little. It's that they want thrills rather than deep satisfactions. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. You know, this is not a homily against television, but I think we would be far better off if no child was put in front of a screen until they were four. And even then, only in limited quantities. And the reason is because as soon as you put them there, we have brain change. The child who spends their time in front of a screen has a different brain than the child that does not. In fact, a large study done in the Northwest, I think it was 1,500 three-year-olds, I'm not sure on the exact number, but they, just this one question, how many hours per day of screen time? And then they went back when the children had gone to school, and so at 5, 2 years later, and asked this question: which children meet the diagnostic criteria for attention deficit disorder? Right. That's the two variables. Hours of TV per day at 3, ADD and ADHD diagnostic criteria at 5. For every hour of screen time per day, there was a 10% increased probability of meeting the diagnostic criteria for ADHD when they went to school. So if you had 10 hours of screen time, basically 100% greater probability of meeting the diagnostic criteria of ADHD. And there are quite a few children who have 10 hours of screen time on a typical day. Changes the brain, narrows it, makes it passive. It narrows the child's world, as opposed to giving the gift of walks in the woods, flowers, trees, exploring all of creation. The infant stage. We talked about that last time, and so I'm going to move on to the child stage. And basically, if infants, in the normal developmental progression, the goal is to master the infant-level relational skills, have a solid joy foundation, can peacefully accept no. Didn't mention that one this time, but huge skill. By the time you're four, you should, a child ideally, now sometimes we take a little bit longer, but ideally has mastered the skill of peacefully accepting no. And let me tell you how that, I should pause and say how that fits with learning to receive. Think about what are the preconditions necessary for a child to peacefully accept no. One, the higher a child's normal joy capacity, in other words, normal state, if life is relationally good and rich most of the time, it's easier for me to take no some of the time. Also, if I trust you, if I trust the person that's saying no to me, it's much easier to take no. If I don't believe you're for me and with me, then I'm much more averse to your no. So in a sense, my capacity to accept no is really directly proportionate to my capacity to accept all the good that you've given me, my capacity to trust you, to find joy in you, to know that even in my no and not liking, and me not liking your no, you'll stay with me and we're together. All of that increases my capacity to take no. Very important, pity the 28-year-old who has not learned to peacefully accept no. Right? Child-level maturity, age 4 to about 12. Primary task to take care of self while being kind to others. Now, one of the first skills here that a 4 or 5-year-old should really start to get good at is to ask for what is needed. And that has to be built on some of those infant-level skills. Let me tell you about Tony. When Tony came to live with us, my parents, as most of you know, I'm the oldest of a dozen. My folks had 9 biological children, 3 adopted children, and numerous foster children, among other people that came into our house that were part of our little tribe at different times. And Tony was one of the foster children. And Tony was 18 months when he came to be with us. And the back of his head was flat. He kind of looked like Charlie Brown, very round head, back flat. Because for 18 months he'd been laid and never picked up, never turned over, never given any attention. As you know, an infant's skull is malleable. So if they're not if they're left in one position, basically his head flattened out. So, a case of extreme neglect. So when Tony first came to be with us, if he fell and he hurt himself, he wouldn't cry. Because it had never done him any good. I mean, he had not learned to trust. He had not learned that there was nobody there that was for him in the first 18 months of his life. But it happened that my youngest biological brother, Josh, was 3 months older than Tony. And Tony was a smart little kid, right? So he looked at Josh and he noticed. When Josh fell, Josh cried. And when Josh cried, Mom came and picked him up. And one day he decided, I'll try and see if that works for me too. And lo and behold, it did. And he started to learn how to communicate what he needed. Now, he was still in the infant level, and actually, it was something of a wonderful, but also one of the harder days in my mother's life is after a couple of years, they found his biological father. And Tony's biological father wanted to take responsibility, and over a series of months came and slowly proved his own competence and his own care. And the day came when my parents handed Tony to his biological father, and last we heard they were doing quite well. But it was that skill of, think how important this is, that I can tell you what I need. That I have enough self-awareness of who I am and a sense that somehow you're for me, so I can tell you.
Thank you for listening to Ambleside Flourish's series on the pursuit of maturity with Dr. Bill St. Cyr, Executive Director of Ambleside Schools International, hosted by Ambleside School of Colorado. Ambleside Schools International fosters an educational renewal based upon the pedagogical insights of British educator Charlotte Mason. Serving an international community of parents, teachers, and schools, Ambleside makes a living education accessible to all. For additional information regarding Ambleside Schools International and training opportunities for principals, teachers, and parents, please visit our website at ambleside schools.com.